Hey there, Shopping Maniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, all about front-end web design and development. I am Dave, heading level 2, Rupert, and with me is heading level 1, Chris Coyer.
I get to be heading level 1? Oh, that's...
Yeah, well,
Thanks. Hey. Too bad there's no H group element to, like, put them both inside, I feel like.
Ooh, we could invent that.
Yeah. Where's the standards people here? Gosh dang it. I'm sick of div class equals subhead, you know? Just needs to be a subhead element. Anyway, this is episode number 367, where we're going to be talking about, I'm sure HTML semantics will come up a little bit, or maybe a whole heck of a lot, but we have two guests that really specialize in accessibility. One of them, a longtime friend of the show, Christopher Schmidt. Hey, Christopher.
Hey. Hey, Chris. Hey, Dave.
Hey. Christopher.org. You might recognize Christopher for, you know, like, I don't know, running a zillion conferences as he has, or the millions of books he's written, that type of thing. And are kind of recently at this company that's somewhat new to you, isn't it? Knowability?
Yeah, Knowability. Yeah, I just started up in January.
January. It's not too new, but pretty new, half a year there. And what is, let's introduce the second guest first, because you both work there, right? We have Nick Steenhout, too. Did I get that last name right, Nick?
You got it spot on. Hi, folks.
Hey, and Nicholas has a podcast as well. So it's kind of a crossover episode, accessibilityrules.com, A11yrules.com. And you're at Knowability too, yes, Nick?
Yeah, I'm with Knowability. I've been working with them for nearly 2 years now. I'm the accessibility testing team lead. But I've been playing with accessibility for nearly 25 years. So it's a topic near and dear to my heart.
Yeah, fantastic. Maybe partially the genesis of the show. This would be a good show to do anytime, but I feel like probably, you know, Dave probably knows a heck of a lot more about accessibility than I do. Dave was a early creator of that website. What is it called, Dave? Why is it?
Accessibility Project, A11Y Project.
Project. You know, so, and Dave's made some pretty cool accessibility resources, like those cards you made recently and stuff. Little jealous. What a wonderful idea. But I know even less. And so probably on this show, probably put my foot in my mouth a little more often than I should about accessibility stuff. And, you know, it comes up pretty regularly, just because how can it not when it's a show about front end web design and development, which is probably where a lot of accessibility stuff happens. I don't know. Maybe these guys could correct me on that if I'm wrong. But it always seems to me like that's the layer at which we can cause harm and fix problems pretty regularly, I think. And then we had a show about Scott Gel, and I feel like, or not about Scott Gel. That'd be funny, though, to have a bunch of people on just to talk about Scott. Show,
not with him, but about him.
Yes. Yeah. With him, where we ended up probably going off on some tangents that we didn't have any business going off on. So I think maybe we can correct some of those mistakes now, and let's just spend the hour talking about accessibility, period. So maybe, like, can we maybe know a little bit more about Knowability, or what you two do, or the type of clients you work with, or just can you give me some kind of understanding of where you come about accessibility in the world?
Well, yeah, well, I'll lay down the foundation for what I know about Knowability, and then I think Nick can probably, like, fill out the outlines a little bit more. But Knowability is a nonprofit organization. So we have services and advocacy programs related to accessibility. And so we do commercial services, like tech services, like auditing and also training and helping clients with remediations. Also, we have other things like AccessWorks, which is a database of people with disabilities that will do usability testing, so you get real feedback on your website about how it performs. Yeah, I was listening to the Hayden podcast that they did earlier, and he talks about, like, you know, doing real research on with real usability testing to find out what really works and not what's the theory about it. So, also we do we have a program outreach for K-12 for teachers to teach them about accessibility training, accessibility technologies, and we also have a conference every year, AccessU, which is a practical training conference that happens in May in Austin, Texas. So that's what we do. Also, I'm pretty sure I'm missing a whole lot. What else do we do?
Yeah, maybe I should preface that, you know, we were talking about H1. So maybe the H1 of Nobility would be really the mission, which is to create a more inclusive digital world for all abilities. So we really are looking at that overarching mission in everything we do.
Is it web, though? Is it like websites, or does it transcend that?
It does in many ways, because it's web, but it's also apps. It's also PDF documents. So anything that is digital information we really play with. Obviously, the primary thing we do is on the web, because most of the digital accessibility really is on the web. But we have worked with people to just make sure all their documentation and resources that are available digitally are all accessible, whether it's on the web or not.
So is it one way you could be working with somebody as they come to you, perhaps on their knees, saying, you know, we have problems and we don't have the expertise to fix it in-house. Can you teach us to be better at it? Or maybe just do it. Help us make our site more accessible. And maybe they do that because they're like just good people in the world and want their site to be better. Or is there other reasons too? Like, oh, we're going to be sued, so we need your help right now.
There's really three types of clients. There's the people that know it's the right thing to do, and they know they don't have the resources or the know-how to do it, and then they come to us to help. There's the people who are aware that it is a legal requirement for them. We work with a lot of education and government agencies, so they really have that right smack in front of them. And then we do have the odd client that comes to us and are telling us, hey, we are undergoing an OCR complaint, Office of Civil Rights Complaints, a lawsuit, and we need to get things fixed. So we work with people. Typically, we will do training to the design tech team, development team, and QA teams. And we do a lot of auditing. And our audits tend to be a lot more than, hey, this bit breaks accessibility, this bit doesn't. We explain what the problem is, for whom it's a problem, how important it is, and we give specific ideas on how to fix it. So ideally, our tools, our reports can be used by all the client's team to actually have a really good idea as to how to fix. And also, it's a learning tool. So ideally, we want them to get to a point where they don't need to come back to us all the time. Obviously, we like working with people. That's not the idea. But we also want people to learn and grow and go forth in the world and spread the accessibility message.
Yeah, you teach a man to button and he'll click his whole life.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And you do teach them, you know, buttons do something, links go somewhere, don't use links for buttons. You teach that over and over and over again until it sinks in.
Oh, that's fantastic. So is that a simple one? Is teaching somebody a link goes somewhere and a button triggers an action and they're different things, and chances are there's some places on your website where you followed that up. That feels to me like, is that like accessibility 101, or is that like a big one still? Like, how much of that is that fall in the bucket of a simple fix, and how much stuff is
accessibility? There's a lot of simple fixes. The funny thing is, you know, I started with accessibility about 25 years ago when a blind colleague came into my office and he said, Nick, what's this website about? The only thing my screen reader tells me is image, 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 image. So I had a look at the site, and lo and behold, it was a site that was using images of text because they wanted fancy fonts. We didn't have CSS back then, so, you know, if you wanted something looking a little bit different than Times New Roman, you needed to use images, but they hadn't put in alt attributes for any of the images, so you ended up with the menu totally unusable for folks who are using screen readers. And that was 25 years ago. And in the last quarter of a century, every single audit I've done, I have to tell developers, use the alt attribute. If the image is decorative, use an empty alt. If the image is informative, make sure that the alt text is clear and concise and describe the purpose of the image properly. And this is ongoing. So this would seem like a fairly low-hanging fruit that by now everybody should get. So is it easy to teach that? Well, yes, but at the same time, something in the system is broken because things that are easy to fix, the difference between a button and a link, using semantic code, using proper heading hierarchy, that kind of stuff is stuff I encounter all the time. I tweeted a couple of days ago, I said, you know, I should write a master accessibility report that I can give to 4 out of 5 clients because I know what issues I'm going to find in the report before I even look at the site. And that was a little bit in jest, but it reflects the reality of the job we do. It reflects the reality that most people out there don't have the training, don't have the knowledge, and I blame the system for that. How many boot camps are excellent but don't mention accessibility? How many computer science programs don't talk about accessibility, or maybe they have 2 hours over the course of 3 years? If people don't know it's out there, then people won't know to do these easy-to-fix, low-hanging fruits.
So it must be discouraging in some ways, and you probably need to find solace in something like, well, we fixed it for one client site, and their site is great now, so hopefully there's some satisfaction in those things. But yeah, it's a little bit of a bummer for to go 25 years and be fixing the same things. But I suppose, I don't know, mechanics change oil every day for 25 years too.
It is frustrating when you look at it at a systemic level, but when you're looking at a one-on-one relationship with clients, with developers, with stakeholders, that actually you see that penny drop in their eye when you talk to them and suddenly they get it. And that is so rewarding because you know that maybe you haven't created an accessibility expert, but suddenly you have an accessibility champion in the organization. And that is so much more important than having everybody being an expert. You need people that understand how important it is and at least understand the basics, because you can always reach out for an expert if you come into a gnarly thing. But if you have a champion that understands that probably 3/4 of all accessibility issues can be solved with very low entry tech solutions, it's good. The more champions we have out there, the better it is. Mm-hmm. And I challenge the auditors of this podcast, inform yourself, read a little bit about accessibility, become that champion in your organization, and you will change the world. You really will.
I like that perspective. I've been in the accessibility stuff game, I guess, tangentially for a while, and I still don't feel like an expert, you know? But I'm very much in this like advocate for accessibility, even if I mess it up. And that's, for me, I start getting into the nuance. Like, it's kind of like, if you do accessibility poorly, you can actually make things worse. And I hear a lot of like, you know, FUD about that, like, oh, you didn't do a good enough accessibility, therefore you did it worse. And so I'm like, what can I do? I messed it up. Is there anything like, so I agree, like, we need more people like championing, but how do we get people like the skills, you know? Is it just through like collective knowledge, or how do we bring people up to up their skill level?
I was talking with a great guy on my podcast last year. His name is Sinabaram. He's a screen reader user who is a brilliant mind in terms of accessibility and awareness. He works with museums quite a bit. And he said something that struck me quite a bit. He said, we don't have an accessibility problem. We have an awareness problem. And I think that really is the answer to your question, Dave, is that we need to increase awareness. We need to build that. And when people become more aware, then everything else is going to flow on. And I keep going back to, we need to get curriculum at computer science programs, at boot camps, to all include accessibility. We need to build that awareness. And unfortunately, right now, what's happening is that there's a lot of lawsuits, and those lawsuits build awareness of accessibility, but in a negative way. But I think last year it was, what, do you remember that number, Christopher? Was it 2,500 accessibility lawsuits in 2018? Something like that.
Yeah, it was almost exponentially higher than the year before.
Yeah. So that is actually quite concerning to me, that there's more and more of these accessibility lawsuits. And in some way, it's almost, I won't say frivolous, because they do raise good barrier. They raise good problems. You know, this site is not accessible. Yes, but we want to avoid serial accessibility lawsuits as well. So we're building awareness of accessibility on one hand, but it's, I think, the wrong way to go about it. The cynical part of me thinks, well, in our environment right now, in the socioeconomic background we have, that's probably the only thing that's going to make a real difference. But maybe we have people out there that are going to include accessibility in the curriculum. I know the Center is a UX school, and students are getting tuition about accessibility in every single class, rather than, you know, something that is forgotten at the end of the program. Oh, and by the way, you should make your website accessible. Okay, now you graduate. Goodbye. So if we see that happening, I think we'll start having a big difference. I think. I hope.
I had somebody write in with this, like, they had some design thing they wanted to do on a table, a data table, you know, the table element, T-head, T-body, T-H, T-D, whatever. And they wanted to do some design thing that just wasn't, you know, tables are weird in HTML and CSS. They do weird layout things, and there's limitations to what they can and can't do, in a sense. And they wanted to do something weird and unusual. I think they wanted, like, rows, like headers intermingled within, you know, like you'd go down 50 rows and there'd be another T-head kind of thing. You know, it just was a design weirdness. But they wanted to do the position sticky thing. So as you scroll up, you know, that new bar would take place of the other bar. I don't even remember if this is exactly what, but it was some kind of design thing. And I think one of the solutions was, it was either to, like, forget using table elements at all. We'll just use a bunch of divs, just div it up, and then you can do whatever you want, you know. Or you can... or we'll use table elements, and then we'll reset all their in CSS. You can just tell it to behave not like a table. Just say display something else. You know, it was one of the two things, and it was only like the conversation. Like the even in my brain, limited accessibility knowledge I have, I'm like, that doesn't feel right. You know, there's reasons why the elements do what they do. You know, there's semantics attached to them, but more than semantics, there's, you know, literal roles. And I'm somewhat aware that elements announce themselves as what they are, you know, and there's probably like a certain way that a screen reader behaves when it hits those elements that is useful and expected versus a bunch of divs, which does nothing special.
Yeah.
But there was no, I didn't even necessarily like blame the person, but it was just interesting that it was just for the furthest thought from their mind, you know, it just was like, what are you talking about? I just want some headers to stay where they are. That's all I want. What are you talking about? You
know,
that they just, the awareness thing made me remind me of that, is that they just had no awareness. You know, it's not that they were like trying to do something nefarious. They just had no idea that there was any problem with that at all. And it's like you give somebody some finger paints and they paint what they wanted to. And then you're like, yeah, I don't like your finger painting. It's problematic. You know, they're like, I don't know. I was just finger painting. It's tough. I don't even know what I'm saying there. It just was stuff. I've used this example before too, is that when I first learned JavaScript, I was so excited because I could take class names and either apply them or not apply them to an element. And I was like, this is the most powerful tool ever. I've just unlocked incredible design possibilities for myself. I can build tabs. I can build them in 2 seconds. I'll have anchor links, and I'm going to pat myself on the back here. I'm going to make the href for those links match the ID of the div that they're pointing to. So I've made this semantic accessible. If the JavaScript doesn't load, it still like scrolls to the page, the appropriate div, or there's some connection between the tab and the thing. Like, nice. Man, I am a good developer, you know? But then JavaScript will take over. And when I click on that link, instead of jumping to where it was, it'll like prevent default or whatever. And then it will toggle a hide show class on all the relevant stuff. Like it'll show what tab is active and it'll show what panel is active and stuff. And through CSS then in those classes, I can design like anything. I could make that an accordion. I could make that a tabbed interface. I could make that the navigation for my entire website if it's simple enough. Like I have all this power now as a developer. Yeah. But I haven't, still to this day, I might do that. Like, I might think about it a little harder now because I'd be like, well, did I do it right, though? Did I move the focus the right way? Like, what have I done here? I'd think about it a little more, but I'd still probably, like, lean on those patterns because they do what I would need them to do. You know, I needed to build some tabs, so I built some tabs.
Yeah.
But I didn't use Aria Current, or I don't even know what roles to use. I still don't really know exactly how to do it the right way. I'd probably like look up some blog posts, find some patterns, see if Dave has something in one of the cards. Like, there's resources out there, but my muscle memory is just to just do it. Just change some classes, you know?
Yeah. Anyway. Hey, do you know what the first rule of Aria is? Talking of Aria?
Don't use it. I think I've heard that one
before. Yeah, yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. First rule of Aria is don't use Aria if there's native HTML elements that will let you do what you need to do. So that is actually one of the awareness things that we come across quite a bit. We see a lot of people that for some reason think, oh, okay, my site, my app is not accessible. I hear that Aria, the Accessible Rich Internet Application Standards and name rules and values will help me make my site accessible. So suddenly they throw Aria on all the things. And what you end up with is actually a mishmash of non-semantic code that actually doesn't really work. So you really should look at Aria as something to make things better. You know, it's like the salt and pepper in your dish. You don't want to use it as your main ingredient. It's just going to enhance the flavors. So yeah, if you have tabbed interface, you would want to use Aria Current attribute, and you would use the value of tab or step or page, whichever, you know, the tabbed interface look like. And that is a good way to use Aria, but you don't want to start using divs and changing the values, the roles, and all that, if you can do it straight with HTML. But of course, how many front-end developers today really know HTML and CSS? I mean, the four of us, we've been around for a while, but baby devs that come out of boot camps and all that, they know how to use frameworks. They know how to use, you know, this technology, that technology, but they look at HTML and they don't really understand what it is. And I don't say this to be controversial. It's just a reflection of what I'm seeing when I'm dealing with clients, when I'm going to PHP conferences even. I speak a lot of those conferences, and the number of times people tell me, oh my God, I didn't know that, you know, I needed to use the heading hierarchy in a specific way. So it's interesting to see.
Isn't it systemic brokenness? Is that, yeah, like if you roll into a job interview and say, I'm an HTML expert, they'll be like, next, you know,
exactly.
Like we need somebody that knows modern stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, like when HTML5 was brand new and I had a talk about HTML5, and one of the things I would do to kick off the, you know, presentation to make it more interactive and get people, you know, stop looking at their laptops was to like get a volunteer and just ask someone to list all the HTML elements that they knew. And then that was like kind of a bridge to talk about all the new stuff that was in HTML5. Mm. And no, really, I think only one person went above 20 elements, you know? Oh. And so it's just, and this is a web design conference, right? This isn't people off the street, right? So it is an issue. I mean, and when you have boot camps that spend like maybe one day on HTML and then, weeks on end on about JavaScript and frameworks, then, you know, it's not a good situation for accessibility in the HTML and allowing the browser to become native. I mean, I remember when I first started out, it was back in the, like, you know, dinosaur age, you know, one of the things I kind of railed on as a designer first and then like a web person second was not to use native browser controls or like native browser form elements. And because they were ugly at the time. They were like deemed ugly. And now it's like I've come like just, you know, like 180. Like I just, you know, why aren't we using native form elements, you know, when we do audits and stuff like that? Like, you know, you should definitely allow the browser to do its job. And
I think that's a huge issue. Like the developer doesn't have the power to say no to design or something like that. So they just say, well, I'll solve this problem with 20,000 lines of JavaScript. You know, I think it's a very common issue, right? Like, and then they end up with something less accessible than the original input, or, you know, I mean, date picker is the classic example. I guess. But, and I mean, even like when you know what you're doing, it's confusing. I ran into the issue where the date picker, okay, I found one that I could use my keyboard on, like up, down, left, right, you know, to navigate the little table of dates. But then when I turn the screen reader on, like this, you know, NVDA sucks up all the arrow keys into, it wants to use the arrow keys. And so then you couldn't use the date picker. Like, it just didn't work. And so I was just like, what do you do? I'm stuck. Mm-hmm. I kind of know what I'm doing and I'm stuck.
Like, that's what I was going for with the, like, what are the differences between, like, oh, you should have used a button here, but you didn't, which is in the simple bucket, you know, you missed an alt tag here or whatever, versus something like that, which is like, I feel like a next level difficult thing, you know? Is there, it feels like the accessibility issues I run into are in one bucket or the other. You know, you have this like longstanding one at CodePen where like it'd be nice if you didn't get tab trapped in an editor, you know, if you get use tab into the editor, but you need to use the tab key because tabs are relevant when you're programming. Well, how do you get out of that? Well, maybe we bind the escape key to it or something. But then if you go back into it, shouldn't it track the cursor position and put you back where you were inside of this replicated text area? Wouldn't that be nice? And it's like, yeah, I have that kind of documented. It doesn't exist on the site, but it's like, it's a hard problem. There's a little bit more nuance to it even than that. And it represents this like decent little chunk of technical debt for our app to like have that thing and support it and make sure that it doesn't break over time. And I'm scared of it. It's in this bucket of like a really hard accessibility problem that like, I'm happy to fix buttons and add alt text all day, but these harder ones.
Yeah.
Nervous.
See, the thing is, if you focus on the easy things that you can do, the straight up HTML fixes, semantic code, use alt attributes and make sure you use, you know, you can go forward and backwards and you don't trap the keyboard and your forms are coded properly and your color contrast are okay, and you know, don't just do gray on gray because it's hell for everyone kind of thing. If you do these things, you will have solved, I would say, up to 85% of the accessibility issues on your site. And 85% of good accessibility, that's pretty damn good. When you have the rest, then yeah, maybe it's more gnarly, maybe it's more complicated, maybe there's no easy straight solutions, but you have a chance to work on that. You have a chance to reach out to experts. You have a chance to actually find solutions because you know that 85% of your other issues are actually non-issues. They've been resolved because you've used the right code, the right way to do it. And then you can ask us, the people that do this for a living, hey, how do I fix this date picker? How do I fix this particular problem? And maybe there's no easy answer, but at least you know you've done the hard lifting. You know, the typical 20% of effort will solve 80% of your problem. So once you're there, you can kind of like take a breather and start looking for solutions.
That's a great message. I love that.
Yeah. You know, don't look at accessibility as something I have to do it all in one shot or not at all. It's incremental. You just iterate through it and you improve it all the time. And yeah, there will be things that are difficult, but the stuff that's easy, just do it.
It seems spiritually connected to the conversations around performance in a way where you're wasting time if you're having a day long conversation about, you know, how fast a for loop is it plus plus I or I plus plus or whatever, when you're like bro, your images aren't even optimized yet.
Yeah.
You're not even serving gzip headers or whatever. That, like, there's the, you know, if that low hanging fruit isn't handled first, you're definitely not prioritizing correctly.
That's what it is.
You know, and then as part of that perf story, some companies are like having performance people. You know, that's almost become a job in a way, just like DevOps somehow became a job and that type of thing. Would you like to see that happen with accessibility? Is it, or are you seeing it happen, like kind of a dedicated in-house people for this stuff?
Yeah, see, I'm going back to this concept of champion. I would like to see an accessibility champion in every single team, in every organization, someone who has an understanding of the basic concepts and that can actually shepherd the organization through the pitfalls, fixing the low-hanging fruits. And would it be nice to have an accessibility expert, someone who really does the thing, the topic? Yeah, sure, it would be. Is it realistic to expect that to happen? I doubt it. The reality is, you know, it is a niche field that, like performance, like security, you need to know someone who knows their stuff, and it can be hard to find. I think the major effort for organization really should be to hire folks that are understanding of the need and passionate about it, and then you can actually reach out to expert if you need. Of course, if you're big enough, you know, you have a company with 1,000 folks on board, then yeah, it might be a good idea to have a dedicated accessibility expert.
Let's say the bar is 1,000. If your company's got 1,000 people on it, one of those 1,000 should be an accessibility
person. Yeah, absolutely.
This episode is brought to you in part by WooCommerce. Today, I want to tell you about three exciting updates to WooCommerce. The first one is that WooCommerce version 3.6 shipped recently and added product blocks. So you can build rich pages with blocks in sites running WordPress version 5 or higher that show products by category, best-selling products, hand-picked products, newest products, and products with specific attributes and more. Super handy if you're using the new Gutenberg WordPress editor. The second cool WooCommerce update is the new WooCommerce mobile app for iOS and Android. You can track your store to see which products are performing best, check revenue, view and manage orders, and get real-time alerts notifying you about store activity like new orders or reviews. So be sure to search for WooCommerce mobile app on the iOS App Store or Google Play today. Finally, if you're running a WooCommerce site right now, you should check out the new Dashboard for WooCommerce Admin that the team released as a feature plugin. It's what's going to eventually be the default dashboard in WooCommerce, but you can check it out right now. You get all sorts of data and analytics on your WooCommerce store with a completely customizable dashboard, new reports, and a new activity panel to alert you to what's happening right now in your WooCommerce store. And if you'd like to see a WooCommerce store in operation, go check out the CodePen shop at blog.codepen.io/shop and try ordering yourself a shirt. The CodePen shop is running on WooCommerce. And the shirt is one of my favorite shirts that I wear each week. Our thanks to WooCommerce for sponsoring this episode of Shop Talk Show.
Do you follow or get excited about or know anything interesting about fixing some of these problems at a platform level? Like it does make sense to me that like somebody like Google could see problems like this and be like, I'd like to fix this, and our specialty is fixing stuff like this at scale to some degree. So like, okay, if alt text has been a problem for 25 years, can we like throw computers at it? Could the default alt text for a image somehow be AI calculated alt text or something? Or does that scare you? Is that a bad idea entirely?
Well, I mean, I'll start first, and then Nick can correct me.
Yeah, I'm going to correct you, Christopher. You're wrong, of course.
So this idea kind of started like talking with Dave, because Dave was a speaker at XSU Online that Nobility put on a while ago, and we just got around to the thought of like, what would happen if Google just went all in on accessibility for a year, and just said like, no, not just, you know. Mm-hmm. Not just the browser, but like, of course, like for us, we view the browser, but just like, you know, everything that they do, just like, oh, hey, we're just going to pause for a second and just, we'll still sell ads and everything like that. Like, we'll still make money. Don't get us wrong, but we're just going to make sure everything that we do is like as accessible as we can make it. And so, and that, I just been thinking about that ever since we talked about it, just in terms of like what would happen if Google just, you know, maybe like on that scale or that systematic level that talked about. And like, and one of the things that came up afterwards, like Becky Gibson, who's on our team, she mentioned like, it'd be really great if the browser just, when someone does target equal like underscore blank, that opens up a new window. That's an accessibility issue, right? That because people who are just clicking a link and they don't know that's a new, opens a new window. That's a big issue. And so, so it would be great if this is automatically hard coded in HTML. The browser says like, well, here's this little like, you know, browser widget icon that's going to show up every time you do this. And, you know, Google being pretty smart about it will make it so that you can style it with CSS. So it's not like a crazy thing, but, you know, you just can't hopefully style it away. And so they're careful. But, what other things could they be doing to make it, to make just native HTML just, you know,
I like stuff like that, right? Like my little example with the tabs, and all I did was change some classes and stuff. You'd think some genius somewhere could be like, you know what? You didn't do all you could here to make these accessible, but I'm going to somehow make them accessible for you because I can kind of heuristically somehow understand what's happening on this page because I'm in charge of layout and I'm in charge of what is visible and what's not visible and what's going on here. Maybe I can infer what's happening and just make it more accessible.
I've heard Rob Dodson and Alex Boxhall from Chrome, they've like floated the idea like maybe there's like browser setting, or maybe if that's too intrusive, like privacy intrusive or something, maybe it's a plugin or something, you know, that, you know, you could enforce focus and just be like, I'm a keyboard user. I know that about myself, or, you know, a tab button kind of user. That's what, I know that about myself. So like in make sure there's a focus state. If there's not a focus state or something on this element, like if you can determine that, like enforce one or something, like, so maybe we could like turn some of these faux pas into like, options that people like, you give people power to like just enforce this all the time because I use this all the time. I require it for my browsing. So I would love stuff like that, but I don't know how far away that future is and how you get dev cycles for that stuff.
I have mixed feelings about the whole thing. I'm very intrigued by the possibilities. At the same time, I'm very hesitant as a disability rights activist. One of the things I've been hearing over and over and over is, you know, maybe wheelchairs need to be better to handle steps. Maybe we need to have assistive technologies interpret images and that kind of stuff, which really puts the responsibility for accessibility on the person who needs it. And I have a problem with that in principle. I think things should be universally accessible and work. Can browsers start detecting focus states or not? That would be awesome if they did. But that comes down a little bit to this concept of accessibility widget. You know, you make a site that's really badly coded, you slap a widget on top where people can increase font size and change contrast and whatever. But if the site had been coded properly in the first place, that widget wouldn't exist. That responsibility on getting the individual to fix things wouldn't be there. And I think, and maybe I'm, you know, I'm dreaming a little bit, but I think that it would be nice if everything was working the right way. The other aspect to that is AI shows a lot of promise, but it's just not ready for prime time. How long has YouTube been providing automated captions? I think it's 10, 12 years, something like that, maybe longer even. And yet to this day, the deaf community refers to automated captions as craptions. It is crap. And it's actually not usable for prime time. So every time I have an encounter where someone says, oh, well, look, AI is wonderful, we're going to use AI, and then that's it. I'm just wanting to pull my hair out. The number of podcasts out there that don't have transcripts is mind-boggling. And when I talk about that, they tell me, oh, okay, well, it's too expensive, it's too difficult, or whatever the reason is. And then they say, I know, I'm going to go use an automated transcription service. And I'm actually right now analyzing 7 different well-known automated transcription service. And I got to tell you, I'm laughing at the outcome, because if I weren't laughing, I would be crying. It is not usable. So AI, yeah, it shows promise, but let's not think about it right now, because until it actually performs a minimum of, you know, 98, 99% of the time, we can't rely on it. And if we can't rely on it, we've just created barriers more than provided solution.
Yeah, I just listened to this. You ever hear the podcast, The Hidden Brain? It's a good one, NPR one. They just replayed a show called The Lazarus Drug, and there was a concept inside of it called moral hazard, which I was hearing about for the first time that I thought was fascinating, which was, it had to do with, like, I don't know, you're a football player and you wear this, there's this amazing new helmet that comes out that protects your head even better. The result of that can be that you just hit harder. Or if you're a drug user and you know that the people next to you have a medicine that can bring you back instantly from a drug overdose, that the temptation is to maybe push the limit of how much drugs you're willing to, because there's this Lazarus drug exists and you give it to somebody and they, boom, they come back to life and it's incredible, you know. And this moral hazard argument plays itself out in all kinds of stuff. And I wonder if it even applies here in a way, if that automated solutions to accessibility problems got much better than they are now, that the temptation would be to play even faster and looser with it, because you just don't, I don't know, computers will fix it, you know?
Yeah. I like the idea of pushing the envelope, you know, go beyond and evolve and get better design and get better coding, because if we don't evolve, we stagnate, we even go backwards. So I'm not against evolution, but I do think there's a risk there of, if we rely on that, oh, well, if I write code, you know, the browser is going to fix it. Well, then what's the incentive for writing good code?
Yeah, there's danger there for sure. It seems like you fix something at scale, you think you're helping the world, it turns out long term you hurt it in some way. Oh, that would suck.
Yeah.
Well, also, it's like the nature of the browser to be forgiving too. So it's like we work in a medium that is forgiving, but also we have to be mindful of how we code, you know, in order to, you know, enact these, you know, make sure our code is accessible and semantic and meaningful. So, I mean, that's like the beauty and the power and also the curse, you know, of the web.
One of the challenges faced when launching your very own startup, business, or personal website is getting a domain name that is available and relevant to what you do and has high recall. If you belong to the tech industry, like many of the Shop Talk Show listeners do, it's ideal for you to choose a .tech domain name. A .tech domain name will make a strong tech positioning for your tech website. Over the last 4 years, many brands, startups, and programmers have adopted the domain name. Brands such as Viacom, Intel, and even the world's largest consumer electronics show, CES, committed to representing their brand on a .tech domain. So if you're a programmer working on a passion project, blog, or personal portfolio, or you're an entrepreneur building a tech business, go secure your .tech domain before someone else gets to it. Head over to go.tech/shoptalk or the link in the description and get yourself a 90% discount on 1 and 5 year domain registrations. That URL again is go.tech/shoptalk and use coupon code shoptalk at checkout. If you're into tech, you got to use a .tech domain.
Is the word that is the data right or whatever? I feel like I kept hearing in all the last few months anyway that some studies came out. Wasn't that the big WebAIM report was the big one, I think, right? That seemed to indicate that things are worse now than they've ever been. Is that the case?
No, mate. things aren't worse now than they've ever been. The only difference is that we are now having the tools to track how bad the situation is.
Okay.
So it's the same bad. It's just
documented. It's not worse. Yeah.
It's the same bad. Okay, now.
Well, and also that you're talking about the WebAIM 1 million pages.
Yeah, sorry. I didn't mean report. To misinterpret that or deliver misinformation. I wanted just some clarity there.
Yeah. No, that's fine.
Well, I want to get to the point, like, because that report was based off of automated testing. Unless you're reading, like, we talked about automated testing and how much that catches versus how much it doesn't catch. And so I think.
Well, that would be an interesting topic if you have things to say there. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, well, Nick probably has as a better percentage of, like, accurate, but I always heard like 20 to 50% of automated tests is catch.
20. It could be as low as 20. So you run this test, you feel good about it because it says there's some contrast green issues check here.
Yeah, before I started working here, I felt good about it. Now I started working here, I don't feel good about
it. So a couple of years ago, a UK government department decided to write the worst accessible page on the internet, and they wrote a page that had 157 accessibility issues, and then they pitched that page against some of the better, most reputable accessibility automated testing tools. And the most performant site identified 37% of issues, which means there's 63% of things that can't be identified. And now we're keeping in mind that this was the best performing one. So you have tools that did catch only about 20% of things. And maybe you want to use a variety of accessibility testing tools. And maybe if you're lucky, they will have overlap and some differences in what they catch or not. But the bottom line is, there's over half of the issues that will never be captured by automated testing tool. I think we have to be careful here with accessibility testing tools. I don't really like them as, you know, as the only solutions to the accessible journey, but they're also very powerful. If you have, you know, you have a site with 300 pages or more and you want to get a feel for the kind of patterns of issues you have, use an automated testing tool to just capture that. Use automated testing tool in your development cycle. So, you know, you don't need to do a full audit all the time, but maybe for each sprint you send that against automated testing tool. And I think it would be fair to say that if your automated tests return dozens of issues, you're likely to find a hell of a lot more stuff out there. But if your testing tools return maybe 1, 2, 3 issue per page, you might be in better shape than you think.
It's like reflective of a whole.
Yeah,
in a way. Yeah.
It's a good way to get a pulse of things. But obviously, you know, we see sites and we have 2 or 3 issues return. Maybe that's a, you know, duplicate IDs or sure, whatever, and then you start digging and you realize that, you know, they've used divs without negative tab index for all interactive elements, so they are not keyboard focusable and that kind of stuff. So
yeah, you can kind of understand too how an automated tool can't necessarily tell that you used a button wrong. It sees a button, like, how does it know how you're using it exactly?
Yeah, it can tell you easily, do you have the alt attribute on an image? Yeah, but it can't analyze the image to tell you whether or not it's decorative or informative. And looking at the context, the same image can have 2 different purposes and yada, yada, yada.
Right. I thought of that right away when I thought of the AI thing. I'm like, if, you know, if some browser's injecting alt text onto your decorative image, you'd be like, hey, don't do that. I left that empty on purpose, you know? You know, just because this show is, we often talk about JavaScript and front-end development in general, whatever modern frameworks are, but let's just think Ember, Vue, React, all that world, is kind of pointed at sometimes as being the ushering of those in is reflective of a drop-off in accessibility. The sites that use frameworks like that, they don't have to be that way, but just broad strokes, they're bad for accessibility. And I think people say That's because it's just so damn easy to write div onclick in them. You know, JSX or whatever in React kind of encourages you to write in that format. And yeah, is that true or is that a false dichotomy or what did I, I'm not even sure if I used that word correctly, but do you see that?
Frameworks. I find them very frustrating a lot of the time. I'm not pointing the finger at anyone in particular, so what I'm saying is quite a generalization. But in general, the people who build these frameworks don't really have accessibility in mind. They don't understand the importance of it, and they don't understand the mechanics of it. And as a result, it's not baked in. Some frameworks, Angular has had some interesting accessibility plugins. You know, it's like you put it in after the fact. It's like if you're baking a blueberry muffin and you try to put the blueberries in after the damn muffin is baked. It's not going to work. If a framework was built with accessibility in mind from the get-go, where all the documentations, all the examples, everything would actually take accessibility into account, then people using these frameworks would actually have a good reference to use and replicate rather than you know, you build something and you realize, oh, it's not accessible, I'm being sued, let me try and find a plugin for this particular framework that will improve things. But it's not gonna be easy. It's gonna be expensive. If you've done it right from the get-go, you don't have increased cost. You don't have increased resource or efforts to do.
Mm. Yeah. So I mean, client work wise, do you see people coming to KnowAbility saying, "Hey, we have some accessibility problems. Check out our site," only to find that it's a framework that has caused the problem in a way?
Very often. Mm-hmm. Very often. You start looking at the first page of an audit and you see, you know, all the classes prefixed with NG hyphen. You know you're going to find problems on the site.
Wow. Okay.
I guess, just dispel some myth-busting. It's not inaccessible because it relies on JavaScript. Or do you, you know, I know a lot of people draw the line. They're like, oh, if I turn off JavaScript, it's a blank page. You know, where do you sit on that fence?
This is a historical thing. It used to be that when you used JavaScript, your site was not going to be accessible. And for a lot of us accessibility wonks that have been doing that a long time, I used to load sites and links just to see how it behaved without JavaScript. Thing is, JavaScript is not... it's not the enemy here. You can actually use JavaScript to make things more accessible, but you have to keep in mind that things need to work without JavaScript, because for whatever reason you still have people that access the web without it. And it's not necessarily the tool itself, it's how you use it. If you use a 10-pound sledgehammer to try to put in the thumbtack, maybe it's not the right tool, but you might be able to do what you need to do if you handle the tool properly. So it's the same thing with JavaScript. It's not evil in and of itself. It's just how it's being used.
Yeah, I'm always not two minds. I just feel like there's two pictures to paint. One of them is this very clear one that there's obviously problems, like there's demonstrable clear problems. There's clients coming to KnowAbility saying our site's a problem. We use this framework and it and you having looked at endless of these sites can identify a pattern there. Like that can't be argued against, I don't think. And like the potential of them. Like I tried to tie it to my example I've used throughout the show as these little tabs where I'm hiding and showing classes, you know? If instead of me writing it myself, it instead reached for some pre-baked tabs component that did the same thing, but it just was written by somebody else. It was a community plugin to do that or whatever. I don't know if plugin's the right word, but in React Land, it would be like a component, you know?
Yeah.
And there are, because there's guys out there, I know guys like Ryan Florence who are like, I'm going to make a tabs component. I'm going to call it reach tabs, and I am going to do everything I can to make this an accessible version of tabs. And then if my muscle memory instead became, I'm going to use those instead of me just handcrafting and just hiding, showing some classes, that in that isolated case, it would be a net gain for accessibility because I've used an accessible solution that was already out there. So in that sense, the framework kind of helped me. Or is that not?
Yeah, it is absolutely true. If we had more libraries out there that actually were fully accessible, then it would be better. But it's a little bit like JavaScript frameworks. Why do we have so many of them? Because people think, hey, I can do better. And there's this proliferation. There's a new tool and a new tool and a new tool and a new tool after that. And the developer out there having to actually find their way through what's going to work best, it can be difficult. So finding, first having the library available is a problem, and then finding it is also a problem. And that's where it's going back. I go back to this awareness thing. If framework developers were more aware, then they could build that in, and then wouldn't be a problem of finding that one library that makes great accessible tab. All the libraries that would make tabs would be accessible.
Yeah. That's great. I see what you mean there. Yeah, like there's like potential, but next week there'll be some new library and it won't have thought of the same things.
Yeah.
And it's not so baked into our psyche that we can be sure that the next library will have learned from the last library's mistakes in this regard. And
yeah.
So maybe this is a good one to go out on. I think Marcy Sutton did a JSConf talk and she's in this sphere of JavaScript, works for Gatsby even. But she had a post called Accessibility is a Civil Right and a talk that goes with it. And that's a big statement, because that gets into human rights and everything. I personally am fine with like moralizing the issue of like website accessibility is a moral issue. But I think we're kind of back to just everything, like, you know, our auditing tools don't quite catch enough, you know, it takes a high level of, you know, knowledge and skill to like test a site and fix a site. If accessibility is a civil right, how do we close the gap on the 97.8% of inaccessible websites? You know, it's hard for me to reconcile, like everybody's messed up and you have to do it or else you're a bad person. Like how do we, I don't know, how does it get, what's, like, how do we close the gap on being totally inaccessible to helping people?
Yeah.
That's sort of how I want to ask that question.
First, I have to say I totally agree with Marcy. Accessibility is a civil right, is what it comes down to. How do we close the gap? I actually don't know. If I knew the answer to that, I would actually probably be rich and have fixed the web. I do think that there's, as I said, I sound like a broken record, awareness issues, but there's these perspective that, yeah, accessibility is a civil right. Accessibility is the right thing to do. But beyond that, if you're running a business, and I would argue that in today's business environment, you know, any dollar you make is good dollar, and if you miss out on it, it's bad. Look at the buying power that people with disabilities have. It's one American in four has a disability. One in four, that's 25%. And sure, not all disabilities out there have accessibility issues on the web, but it's still a significant minority. So if you're cutting out, say, even half of that, say you're cutting out 12% of business right there because your site is not accessible, whether or not it's the right thing to do, whether or not it's a civil right, it doesn't make any business sense either. So we have to think about that. And then, of course, there's the legal requirements that, hey, you know what? Your site has to be accessible by law. And again, that comes back to civil civil rights. There's laws around the civil rights as well. So how do we make all these sites that are not accessible, how do we make them accessible? Well, right now for us at Nobility, it's one site at a time that we help people improve the situation. It's on Twitter doing advocacy. It's building awareness out there. And hopefully, eventually, it's going to sink through. But going back to what I was talking about earlier, let's try to improve accessibility tuition in all the places where people learn about web, computer science, tutorials, boot camps, that kind of stuff.
Great. Christopher, you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I have to echo that. I mean, I think one of the additions to my CSS cookbook I wrote was I had just a chapter on how to write semantic markup, just because I wanted people to write semantic markup, because then their CSS is cleaner and leaner. And so did I have to write a chapter about HTML in my CSS cookbook? No, my editor probably would have liked it if we didn't, publish it, if we didn't put it in there, but I just felt like it was important to put it in there and make sure people know that, to apply CSS correctly and cleanly, you would want to have clean HTML. And so that's just one place, to put it, the education where people learn. And going forward, and then just start with the simple things, and like the simple things start growing into bigger things. And, one of the things we could talk about is just on the way out is also just the lowest hanging fruit for accessibility improvements, right? Just the biggest problem that in the Web 1 million project that was found was color contrast. And so I just encourage everyone who's listening just to check out their work website, their personal blog, and just say, hey, is my color contrast issue, correct? It's like, do I have any issues with that? And if so, just correct them and, deploy the website, and you've made like one small step forward.
Is it Robin Rendell says, like, make the design system better 1% at a time. Yeah. Just kind of trudge forward. So, well, cool. Well, thank y'all so much for coming on. We should probably wrap up the show. I could talk a million minutes about this stuff. So I really appreciate your time. Nick, for those who aren't following you, how can people follow you and give you?
Well, I have Twitter, which is Vavroom, Vavroom. I'm on Patreon at patreon.com/STEENHOUT. Of course, my podcast is A11YRULES.com. And I invite folks to come check out the Nobility website as well. That is KNOWBILITY.org.
Awesome. Christopher Schmidt, how can people follow you and give you money?
I'm on Twitter as well. It's Telejct, TELEJECT. My website needs work, but it's Christopher.org. And also you can see me at the Artifact Conference, which is I'm one of the co-founders there. So we'll have Al Waters there speaking about accessibility, as well as some other great speakers like Dave and Chris.
Hey, come on down to Austin Town. Bing, bing, bing. So, all right. Well, thank you all so much for coming on. Again, this is near and dear to my heart. Very, I don't know, very timely as I stare down 300 accessibility issues in my client's backlog. So really appreciate it. So, and thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to start our favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you and Chris. You have anything else you'd like to say?
Footer. ChopDocShow.com, close footer.
Roll content info.